Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I am your host, Susan Laris and Danz. And tonight, hopefully if all things go well, we're awaiting a call from Kevin Miller, who is the writer, director, and a producer on Hellbound, which is a really interesting documentary that is touring the country right now. And I can see Kevin is on the line now, and so I'll bring him on in just a second. Just want to tell you a little bit about Kevin. Kevin's an award-winning screenwriter, director, and producer who has worked on multiple documentaries, feature films, and shorts. And what's so interesting about this film, which is really quite a courageous film, that is going around the country, one that I have not yet seen because it's coming to Portland very soon next week, is that it not only asks that very provocative question of do you believe in hell, but also why do you believe in hell, of people of multiple persuasions, and even more importantly, how does this belief in hell impact us as a society overall? So without further delay, I'm going to go ahead and bring Kevin on the show. Wait a second. A little delay here. Here we go. Hello, Kevin. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here. As I said in the intro, what you've done truly is a courageous thing, and you're talking about a subject that many are afraid to discuss openly. Why is it, Kevin, that people are afraid to venture into this topic?
Well, you know, I don't know if everyone's afraid, but some people are. I think people who really believe strongly in the idea of eternal torment in hell. It's kind of like the dirty little secret of Christianity in a sense that mm-hmm. that it's something people want to downplay because Christianity is supposed to be about the good news and hell definitely doesn't sound like good news. And so I think on one side people want to say, well, let's emphasize the love of God and kind of the benefits of being a Christian as opposed to the downside of not being a Christian. And I think, you know, there's also a fear amongst those people that if you start to ask questions about hell, well, it's in many people's minds, questioning the traditional view is the same thing as really questioning the truth of Christianity itself. And so if we pull up the thread of hell, well, then what else is going to come along with it? And I think that, you know, in one sense, those fears are really well-founded because, as I've discovered, once you pull up the thread of hell, everything else about Christianity is on the table because I think, by and large, in the Western Church, which would be Catholicism and a lot of forms of Protestantism, hell, you could reduce a lot of the theology to a hell avoidance plan. And so hell becomes actually foundational to the faith. And I think there's a lot of people who would argue that's a real, actually a distortion of what Jesus actually taught, that Jesus didn't teach how to avoid hell after you die, that Jesus was more concerned with helping us avoid creating hell on earth. And so, you know, I think that it just becomes something really uncomfortable because it threatens really core beliefs for a lot of people.
Well, just to give you a feel for where I'm coming from, because I think I'm probably in a group that you really are trying to reach, Kevin, just having read some things about this film, is I came from a very strong evangelical background. My family was very involved in the church. There was an influence on our family because my grandfather was a minister evangelical minister, although I didn't know him well, but it had an influence on the family. And I became so anguished over the concept of an angry God and hell that I really ran away from all forms of spirituality for many years. And until I had a kind of a brief encounter with my own mortality when I got a bit older, I had to face it. And then the question was, am I going to hell because I'm doubting? And I went through quite a bit of anguish. And it's kind of funny because some of the people you interviewed, just so happened I was in Kansas City, so I happened to encounter more than one international, well, they used to call it IHOP. I don't think they're allowed to anymore, but International House of Prayer people. I didn't really know the head, but people around that, and it's a really powerful force in that area. And I will tell you, just to make a long story short, I am still, and I think I represent quite a few people, trying to find a home for the love-based concepts in the Bible within my belief system, trying to figure out how to embrace that. I know that I believe in the love of God, and I know that I question hell, and I'm not an atheist or an agnostic, but I do question a lot, and I know exactly what you're talking about. The minute you take hell away, well then, what are you being saved from? I guess that's the first question a lot of evangelicals and people would ask, is that if you have no hell, then, you know, I've been asked this, then what did Jesus do? Is Jesus a great teacher? Or how was that reflected through your work?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that's a very natural response, and I think it's a very revealing response, that when you ask questions about hell, suddenly, well, then Christianity doesn't seem to make sense anymore. And so it shows me that everything in a lot of evangelical Christianity is actually resting on hell, even maybe if people aren't even aware of it. And so, yeah, the natural question, well, why did Jesus die then? And why bother being good? And, you know, why tell other people about the gospel and all this sort of thing? All the, you know, it just causes a total rethink of your life. And again, I think what it gets back to is the beginning of the story. And I think the way I was raised, the beginning of the story is this, is that God made this perfect world, but humans sinned and ruined it. And God became very angry at that. And he's angry at sin and wrathful. And so, you know, we're either going to have to bear the brunt of that unless somebody can come and bear it for us. And so that's why Jesus dies on the cross, and that Jesus' death on the cross is essentially God's punishment that was supposed to be for us, but he carries it out on his son instead. And so then if we accept that, then we can avoid the wrath. If we reject it, well, then we're going to have to face the wrath in hell. So it's funny because on one side it says that God's wrath was satisfied by the death of his son, but on the other side it says that actually, no, if you don't accept it, God's wrath is still going to burn for all of eternity because of our sins. So it's all about the central problem of humankind is avoiding the wrath of God. Yeah. And what I would say is if that is the story, well, then hell does seem to be necessary. But I would disagree on that story. And I think that the story instead is that human beings, once we attained self-consciousness, very quickly comes an awareness of mortality. And the minute you realize you're going to die, as a very young child, this hits a child, and I watched this happen with my three-year-old daughter. Around that age, you start to become aware of mortality. My little girl came up to my wife about 6 months ago and said, Mommy, and she was crying. She said, Mommy, when I die, I'm going to be all alone. And it was just this sad, I mean, heart-rending moment, but you could see that this awareness of death came upon her. And what this does to people is that the minute we realize that we're going to die, this puts us in a defensive posture because now everything we're going to do from that point onward is going to be to somehow avert death or to transcend death by finding a way to, you know, in a sense, become immortal. So this, and to find a sense of significance, because death seems to render everything you do insignificant, because it wipes you from the face of the earth. So how can we overcome that? Well, the problem is, if I'm going to be significant, that means I have to be more significant than you. So death awareness immediately puts me in competition with you and everyone else around me, and it makes us self-centered and defensive and all these kinds of things. And I think this is what the Bible is trying to show us, is this whole civilization we built, which is really founded on the murder of Cain killing Abel, is a society that's based on violence and death and, you know, this fear-driven, death-driven culture. And I think that what Jesus comes to do is to reveal that fact to us, to reveal that to us that the organizing principle or the logos of human civilization is violence. And he submits himself to that on the cross as a way of revealing to us really the lie that we've been living. But then he also defeats death as a way of setting us free. And I think this is really key, is that a lot of people think the central act of Christianity is the crucifixion because that's when the debt was paid.
Yeah.
But I see the crucifixion much differently. I see the crucifixion is us. This is our no to God. And this is an act, a very human act, where we literally crucify God, where this is an expression of human wrath against God, not divine wrath against his Son. But the resurrection is the real central moment, because this is the defeat of the thing that's been causing the problem at the beginning. So it's not about avoiding God's wrath. It's about being rescued. That this is really Jesus coming on a divine rescue mission. And that paints a very different story. And it suddenly, I think, renders the whole notion of eternal torment in hell nonsensical.
You know, I have to... No, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's no need for it, because this isn't about crime and punishment. It's about bondage and freedom. It's about people being friends.
You know, there's something about that concept of hell where when you were once taught it, as I was many years ago, and also entertained it as an adult. I mean, I certainly pondered it and anguished over it for a long time. At some point, you realize, oh my, I mean, it's just so harsh. How could you ever think that a loving God would use any mechanism like that, that it doesn't seem wise or the best way to address the problem? And I know that people say you shouldn't question God. You know, there's always that barrier put up in many churches where you're not allowed to question, and that even to ask that question, you know, how dare you try to get into the mind of God, which is often used. And yet it's just so incredibly harsh to ponder hell.
Well, I think you're right. And you know, I would say that if you're in a religion that says you shouldn't question God, and that, in fact, questions could lead you to hell, that's a form of mind control. That is not equivalent to what Jesus says, where my yoke is easy and my burden is light. If you are being corralled by fear, you should ask yourself if you're actually caught up in some form of a cult, because that's, you know, that's really the definition of a cult, is something that where you're adding something to the Bible or to Jesus, and it's motivated by fear, and then you become inoculated against somebody who might try to call you out of that. People will warn you, say, yeah, there'll be wolves in sheep's clothing who will come and try and teach you something different, but they're going to be from the devil. Well, you're in a really difficult position then, because you're afraid to fear. You're afraid to ask questions because you might go to hell. And if people come along to try and introduce you to an alternate point of view, you look at them as if they're from the devil. I think that puts you in a really difficult position. And I think that, you know, who can know the mind of God? In a sense, I would agree with that. But the funny thing is, if we go to the Bible and we read some classic verses like Isaiah, who will say, you know, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. And there's a sense of, how dare you question me? But the funny thing is, that's in the context of God being merciful to his enemies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how dare we question God if he wants to be merciful to who he wants to be merciful to? And the same thing in, you know, another one that's often brought up is in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13, people will say, well, we see through a glass darkly, but then we'll see face to face.
Yeah.
Well, again, this is in the context of describing the love of God, which keeps no record of wrongs, a love that never fails. And it's a love that's incomprehensible, because that's not how we love. We have a very inferior way of doing things, and God always, his love and his forgiveness and his grace always far exceeds ours. So again, I would come back and say, if your theology of hell is somehow inferior to the best that human beings can imagine, I would say that that doesn't sound like revelation to me. That sounds more like a human projection that sounds like a projection of human limitations onto God.
You know, and I would agree that I think it's difficult for us to fully understand what it means to love unconditionally. And that passage that you quote from 1 Corinthians, I think that's what it's all about, unconditional love, love without conditions. And to me, thinking that you have to be saved in order to be spared is a huge condition. It is very much conditional love. And I think those who defend that concept probably would defend that and say, yes, there is a condition. Or they may say you're loved, but, you know, you made the free choice. That's the other argument I've heard so many times is that God doesn't condemn you to hell. You make the free choice to condemn yourself. And one question I always had is that if you're being supernaturally deceived, which is part of the dogma, you're being supernaturally deceived, how is it a free choice? Because obviously, because they create this, the deception that they describe is so incredibly severe that you don't know if up is down or down is up. I mean, you are just totally confused by supernatural deception. So how could anyone make a free choice? It seems like it would be rigged. And to me, it would seem like this concept of Satan would win because, you know, everyone's being deceived and can't make a choice.
Yeah, no, I think you really hit on something. Because, I mean, really, there's two ways within Christian theology to get to hell. The one is God will send you there. And so the Reformed or Calvinist view will say they have a doctrine of predestination or election, so that even before you're born, God chooses who will go to heaven and who goes to hell. Or another version of it will be God creates us, but we all turn against him, and so we all, in a sense, through our will, bring sin upon ourselves, but then God chooses to save some of us. But then you have the other branch of the church would be Arminianism, where there's a huge emphasis on free will. And so it's all really incumbent upon you. And I would reject both, to be honest, because I think that God choosing if God actually is a God of love and he loves everyone, but he chooses to save some and not others from hell, well, that's really problematic, because a father who had four children in peril, and he could have saved all four, but he only chose to save one, we would arrest that guy. You know, that's a criminal offense to not
save. It's cruel.
It's cruelty, and it's inhumane, and it's everything that we abhor. So why on earth would we, impugn God with such a character? But the other side of it is the free will side, where we have, I think, an illusion. Honestly, I think we live under the illusion of free will. And I think it's not even a biblical concept. Let's look at the pivotal story in the book of Genesis, where Eve eats from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. People will often say, well, that's Eve. She abused her free will, and that's why, she brought sin upon us. But I don't see any evidence of free will in that passage, because the first thing we see happen is that this snake comes along and deceives her. Well, clearly, prior to the snake coming along, she must have been in bondage to ignorance, or else when the snake told her this stuff, she would have easily refuted it. But she didn't, so she mustn't have known God very well. So she was in ignorance, and then she falls under deception from the snake, but then also fear, because she thinks that God is withholding something from her, so eating from the tree is almost a preemptive strike against God. So by the time she eats the fruit, her will is in bondage to ignorance, deception, and fear. Where is the free will? It's nowhere to be found. And so I think that that story is meant to show us that we are under the same spell, and that the whisper of the snake is the whisper of so many things around us that deceive us into thinking that God is out to get us. And so we almost launch a preemptive strike against God because we don't trust him to be good. We don't trust that he has our best interests at stake. And so I think that what's going on is that, as you know, the atheist Sam Harris actually, I think, is doing some of the best work in this regard to show us that the decisions that we make are the product of a will, but it's a will that's being driven by all kinds of forces, most of which we are totally unaware of. So the way Harris would put it is that we live downstream from a whole bunch of unconscious influences, And so by the time we get around to making a decision, half the time we don't really even know why we made it. And so to say that somebody would be sent to hell for making a decision that was motivated by all these unknown forces, it just doesn't make, again, it just seems to impugn the idea of justice.
Well, and you know, you always ask the obvious questions, like what if a person is mentally ill, for example, can't make any decision logically? I mean, how could that person be condemned to hell? Or, you know, there's a whole list of people. And ultimately, how can anyone be condemned to hell? It just doesn't make sense.
What people will do is to deal with, you know, the mentally disabled or children or, you know, people maybe who never heard about Jesus, his
ideal.
There's this huge inflation then of levels of hell or different, you know, intermediary points in the afterworld. And to me, it just sounds more and more ridiculous, because what you're doing is amending this theory to try and shore up the holes. But ultimately, I think what you just need to realize at a certain point is that the theory just makes no sense. And you know, again, it comes back to the fundamental story of of Christianity. And if Jesus is the Savior, what is he saving us from? What is he saving us to? And I think that over and over again, as I read the Bible and reflect on what Jesus is doing, is that he seems to be dealing with people who are obsessed with looking on to the next world, but looking past the people in this world. And what he seems to be doing all the time is saying, I want you to focus on this life, because if you don't, bad things are going to happen, but it's not going to be God imposing them on you. It's going to be the natural consequences of living a self-centered life.
Yeah. And that's why loving one another and all those, the main lessons that are taught are so important. You know, there's something else about this whole concept of hell, and I know you get at in your film how it affects society, but something that I've personally encountered, and I was wondering what you would think about this, is just how heartbreaking, and I mean heartbreaking, it is with the personal relationships we have with those who love us, whether they're friends or relatives who think that we are going to hell. And, you know, I'll tell you, several years ago, because I was only brave enough to write this anonymously at the time, because this topic is so challenging to openly approach when you come out of evangelical Christianity, I posted a question on a Christian apologetics forum, which was really popular at the time. And my question was based on my relative's concern, or a particular relative's concern, about me going to hell, and how it actually broke my heart that she would be anguishing over me. And I just didn't know how to help her. And then the question became, how could anyone be happy in heaven if they have loved ones in hell? You know, and it's really kind of a trap, that question. And I'll tell you, it went to the top of the forum. It was totally anonymous. It was, nobody knew I even wrote it, but it got so many replies, and it's a question you can't answer, because is God going to erase your mind so you don't remember the person? You know, are you just not going to care, so then you have no empathy, and is that a good way to be in heaven? And so it's just a very heartbreaking thing within our relationships, having this concept of some people going and some people not going.
Well, I think, you know, my answer is this, is that if there is an eternal hell where people are in torment, and if God is a loving God, if Jesus really is the epitome of the Father, there's no way that he could not be in hell for eternity ministering to those who are suffering. And if there's saints in heaven who really actually do experience the love of God, they're going to be right behind him. So if there's a heaven and a hell, heaven will be empty, because
all the true Christians will be down in hell.
They'll be down in hell trying to minister to the lost if they actually have experienced love.
Although,
and
there you
so,
go. Yeah.
Yeah, I that's the way I see it, because love, the deeper you love someone, the more interdependent you become. I mean, I have four kids, and to me, if they suffer, I suffer. And the more they suffer, the more I suffer. And so, again, Jesus told us that God is the Father. He told us to refer to God as a Father. And so, clearly, that's the frame of the relationship. So the more we suffer, the more God will suffer. And by extension, the more those who love God and love each other will suffer. And I think this is what Jesus is really trying to show us, with the two greatest commandments, to love God and to love your neighbor as yourself, is that our interests are utterly interdependent, in that you know, we aren't these isolated monads, that we aren't even individuals, we're interdividuals, and that he's trying to show us that our actions matter so much because there's this interdependency of love. And so, yeah, I think your question is perfectly valid, and it shows, I think, that the logic of hell just isn't there on so many different levels. I mean, the other thing I would say, if you have a radical notion of free will where you say, well, you can choose, you know, it's up to you, you better make the right choice, you're going to go to hell. Well, basically,
right.
Heaven then is going to be full of a bunch of people congratulating themselves on making the right decisions. But I'll say this, if that's how strong free will actually is, heaven's not going to be safe. Because you'll always be in the danger that your free will lead
will
you right out of heaven.
Cause you to question. Well, you know, that's a really good question too, Kevin, because what caused this rift to begin with? I've often wondered this too within, you know, the traditional story here is, are you, you know, there seems to be this assumption that once you go to heaven, it's going to be happily ever after. Well, you know, that's not the story of heaven that we were taught. I mean, there was rebellion in heaven. There was obviously free choice within that story. And so, as you say, there's no guarantee that you would eternally be in heaven, I mean, within that scenario. Now, for me, I could never trust a God. I didn't think I would want to be in heaven. You know, there was something that I saw in your teaser, I think it was Mark Driscoll, and I've actually seen him speak. I happened to be in the audience. It was a very big audience for the ABC Nightline debate on the existence of Satan. It was up at his church,
oh, yeah.
And they filled
that.
The mega church. Yeah, and it was just filled with people. And you had people of all different persuasions in the audience. And probably in some ways the most interesting part were the conversations afterwards, because, you know, we were all talking amongst each other. But anyway, one of the things Mark Driscoll said was that it's cowardly to not believe in hell. And he, in the teaser, I think you show a picture of Rob Bell when he's saying that, and like that may be one of the people that he's thinking of. And you know what? To me, it's actually more courageous to have the guts and the conscience, really, to say no. You know, if that is what's being presented as God, you know, that really would be, in his case, even pseudo-Calvinistic. I don't fully understand what he believes, but I know Calvinism is part of it. It's kind of neo-Calvinism. But if that's part of it, then as a person of conscience and courage, I would say that's not God, and that's not someone I can trust, and I'm looking for God. I mean, to me, that entity, whatever it would be, would not be God. That would mean my search for God is not over, you know, and that I would be looking for the loving God that I experience and know, because many of us do know that love.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, and I think that what that God is some petty tyrant that is offended so easily that, you know, he must have satisfaction. Now, this is an idea that very much comes out of an age, you know, again, this goes back to a theory of the atonement as well, that goes back to Anselm, you know, so 1,000 years ago, where that was the world, where there were, you know, people of high status, and if you did an offense against them, that the law was structured so that an offense against somebody, you know, the degree of punishment you would get would be equal to the status of the person you offended mm-hmm. against. And so, you know, many people have this idea that a sin against an infinite God requires an infinite punishment. And I kind of laugh and say, well, how about this? A sin against an infinitely loving God demands an infinite loving punishment.
Oh, I love that. I've heard that, by
the
way, more than once, that argument. That is a common argument, that exactly what you say. And I've never heard that response. That's a really good one, Kevin.
Well, I think it, you know, and it's not original to me, but it's something that I've kind of heard in universalist circles.
Yeah.
I thought, we take one quality of God, and then we make And then we say, well, that's the standard. So I would say, okay, how about a sin against an infinitely just God demands an infinitely just punishment? But it's more always framed in the sense of you sinned against God, and he, you've done the ultimately bad thing, and you know his wrath will rage for eternity. I mean, again, you just these, I think, just ridiculous images of God, who is emotionally immature. You know, like we can imagine. People who are not like that, never mind, you know, if that's the way God is, I mean, you just have to really wonder what's wrong with him.
As if we're subject to a Roman emperor or something. I mean, that it really does feel that way, a capricious king of old, you know,
it's a primitive
system.
Who's bound to just say off with his head because we've somehow offended him. And he's completely self-centered. And again, this is so contrary to the view of Christ, who is constantly doing exactly the opposite. He's making himself low. He's reaching out to those who are outside the circle of holiness. He is going to the proud and challenging their notions of holiness. He's saying, well, you better be careful, because that hell that you believe in, guess who's going to be the first one who ends up there? You. Because the measure you give will be the measure you receive. And he's constantly saying that this sort of insider and outsider thing is going to come back and bite us, because it creates a world that is just, it's the exact opposite of the kingdom that Jesus is trying to usher in on earth. And, you know, interesting comment about hell as well is, there's a guy named Lee Griffiths who written a book called The War on Terror and the War on Terrorism and the Terror of God. And he, I believe, is a universalist, and he was teaching at a Christian college, and one of his students discovered that he didn't believe in hell, and he became very concerned about it. And Lee said, well, I'll make you a deal. He says, if we die and we both end up in heaven and hell exists, you join me and we'll protest God until he shuts it down. And I thought, you know, that really, to me, displayed such a guy who really, I think, gets the heart of God. And it's not... It's a heart of love. And now this is not to say, now I can hear the objections to say, well then, you know, how we live even matter? And I would say it matters so much. And again, this is what Jesus is trying to show us again and again. And are there consequences to the way we live our life? I definitely believe we live in a cause and effect world. And if there is a life beyond this life, I see no reason why it would be any different. And that the damage we do in this world, we will have to account for in the life to come. And now what that looks like, I don't know. But I would say that just as we don't engage in wanton acts of violence in this world, because we rightly fear the consequences, and we know the emotional and psychological damage we can do to ourselves and others, well, I think that, you know, we need to keep an eye on, you know, if you believe in eternity, in that as well, because why wouldn't there be consequences to the way we live?
Yeah.
The question just becomes, is the punishment that we might face an end in itself, which is eternity in hell, or is it a means to an end? And that would be where many universalists actually believe in a form of hell, but they believe it's ultimately redemptive, and that God's goal is ultimately reconciliation, not just between us and God, but between each other.
You know, I found myself reflecting upon the story of Darth Vader one day, and on multiple levels, in the sense that there often is this almost gleeful, although I will say that's way on the extreme, but there still is this desire to punish the wicked, so to speak. And yet, the question I have, just using this symbol of Darth Vader, is how come we were all so happy, you know, those of us who saw the original films when they were out, that he was redeemed and rehabilitated and he turned around? Why do we cheer the prodigal son, so to speak? We don't want to see that person punished. We cheer. Very few people at the end of that movie probably said, what, you know, he killed all those people, he should have been punished. So this really brings up, in our society, we have this notion of punitive, even vengeful justice. But in our hearts, is it really what we want to see? And sometimes, you know, you being a filmmaker, film has a way of bringing out our true underlying emotions. And that's why that story of Darth Vader, to me, is actually very hopeful in the way that we all react to that and how we embrace that he turned around and how we cheer the person who turns around.
Yeah, well, you're speaking to a lifelong Star Wars fan, so you're
oh,
speaking
great. Out.
But, yeah, no, it's funny. I teach screenwriting and on the side, and that's something I've actually drawn out several times, is that very point is that, you know, Luke doesn't just defeat Darth Vader. He saves him from himself. Now, the one person who doesn't get redeemed is the Emperor, but that's, I think we all can agree with that, because what a horrible end. And I think that the Emperor could have been saved as well, but at the very least, Darth Vader is saved. And I think that's what true heroism is not somebody who just beats the bad guy, but somebody who holds out grace to the perpetrator of great evil to save him or her from themselves. And we all see that as the highest justice, the highest good that could possibly be imagined. And I think you're right that the problem is that I think we end up having a failure of imagination when it comes to hell, is that we think the best God can do is the best that we can do. And the best that we can do is to punish or to kill. And we try to rehabilitate, but ultimately the final word is violence. And this is the question I would have for people is with someone like Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden, or, you know, you can Stalin, you know, you can take any number of these rogues from history. And I would say to a Christian, they would say, well, how could God possibly, you know, how, I mean, these people deserve to be in hell for eternity. But I would say, you know, do you really believe that God is the creator of the universe? Do you believe him when he says, behold, I'm making all things new? Just imagine for a moment that God had the power to undo all of the damage that Hitler had caused, to restore the lives of those who've been killed, to restore them to their families, and, you know, that all the wrong that had been done had been made right. What would you want to do with Hitler then? I think most people would say, actually, I'm not too concerned about him anymore. I'm just happy to be back with my family. And I think that we are, again, always looking through this through human limitations. And I would say we need to imagine a far greater justice than would ever be possible in our hands. And I think the possibilities then become so, you know, just so fantastic, that imagine perfect justice carried out by someone who is perfectly loving. I mean, my, that's something to make you hopeful, not something to make you just shake your fist and go, I can't wait till they get their punishment. Because, boy, what about us? I mean, I haven't lived a perfect life.
No, none of us have.
No, and so, I mean, I think we all have good reason to fear, but I think we have even better reason to hope. And I think that's what Jesus is trying to show us, is that put your hope in me, because you guys, there's no one righteous, not even one, but that's not the point. The point is that I'm trying to show you how to come out of hell, come out of this hell that you're creating. I'm not coming here to warn you that you're going to end up there, but I am warning you that if you continue down the path you're going, you are going to reap what you're sowing.
You know, to me, it takes real courage, and we tread on perilous ground, or I'm about to just even talk about Hitler, but, you know, to me, the thought that Hitler could be taught, you know, what if God is so very loving that God could take Hitler and unwind Hitler's life and say, okay, here's step one where you went wrong, here's step two, you know, this is what I'd like to believe, and just say, okay, let's look at this, and then, you know, of course, he would, you know, be crying in remorse at some point. And you know, to me, that is the ultimate injustice, not locking or punishing someone, you know, throwing away the key. It's turning them around. And, you know, I will say that personally, spiritually, you know, I have looked down the road of reincarnation, for example, which I know I'm really hard to label. I mean, I can't really call myself a New Ager anymore. I was for a while, and I sort of am. I mean, I circulate in those circles to some degree, but I don't really belong. I don't really belong anywhere, Kevin. I'm kind of floating in between. And I think there are quite a few people like me, actually.
I was going to say, I think there is, actually.
And we don't really have a home, but we can feel the love of God. I mean, more and more, I was distanced from the love of God by the fear of God. I mean, it was almost like having an abusive parent. I just couldn't get close. And I knew friends who felt they had a personal relationship. I mean, and I believed they must have. But for me, it was really challenging in that belief system, and I felt like I was lacking. But then when I was able to turn away from the harsher beliefs, it was then that I began to really experience the love of God. And you know, honestly, it was a heartfelt request. Just show me the way. It was after I had kind of this brush with mortality. And, you know, it was just that. Show me the way. It was as simple as that. And that started to turn things around for me, just being open to the answer.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I mean, that I think that's a common story, you know, in what you're saying. And it's, you know, this is one of the problems. You know, you don't, if you want to make a lot of money, you write a book or make a movie that really tries to pound people with this idea of eternal hell. I mean, you reinforce the majority position. When you question the status quo, you know, that puts you in a precarious position. It's, you know, I think in some ways put me in a bit of a precarious position.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I reached a point where I found I just couldn't keep going. And that for me, the most freeing thing in the world was to begin to rethink these things, to rethink the atonement, to rethink hell, and to just totally rethink Christianity as a whole. And the funny thing is, and this is what we really show in the film, in Hellbound, is that throughout the history of the church, there has been a wide variety of views on this topic. I was raised in a tradition where it was kind of an unspoken thing that there's only one way to think about this, and those other people who might question it, well, they're not really Christians. But that's a very difficult argument to sustain when you think of someone like Gregory of Nyssa, who helped canonize the Bible. You know, he argued for having four Gospels in the Bible. He also was the final editor of the Nicene Creed, which is the most universally recognized creed in all of Christendom. And it just so happens that Gregory of Nyssa did not believe in eternal torment in hell. And so, again, it's pretty difficult to use the Bible to say that anyone who questions eternal torment isn't a Christian, when one of the people who helped compile the Bible didn't hold that view. And so,
that's,
you know, this is where it's one of the reasons why I wanted to make Hellbound, was to introduce people to this idea that the history of the church, we have many people we regard as fathers and mothers of the church, all the way up into the 20th and 21st century, who do not believe in eternal torment. The whole Eastern Orthodox Church has never believed in that. And, you know, are you going to question their faith over that? I think they would have a lot of things to say to you if you did, because they would lay claim to being one of the oldest churches in the world. And so there is a wide variety of views within the church. There always has been. But due to historical circumstances, certain views have become dominant and other ones have become more of minority positions. And I think that the history of Christianity is a history of trying to work this stuff out. You know, something, I was in Bible college back in the late 1980s, early 90s, and it was shortly, it was right around that time that the famous British theologian named John Stott, he declared that he could no longer buy the idea of eternal torment, and he actually felt that annihilationism was a better interpretation of the Bible. Clark Pinnock was another guy who came out at around the same time, and it caused a huge uproar. And people just didn't know what to do because they had so much respect for John Stott, but, you know, now he's questioning hell. What are we going to do? And the funny thing is 20-some years later now, if you believe in annihilation instead of eternal torment, most Christians will say, well, I think you're wrong, but you're not dangerously wrong.
And no, they just see that it's a different version
acceptable.
Of hell.
Yeah, well, I think maybe just because it does retain the punishment element. But I wonder if 20 years from now we're not going to be saying the same thing about universalism or the idea of ultimate reconciliation. Because, again, many people, in fact, most people I know who believe in universalism believe in some form of postmortem punishment. They just don't think it will last forever. So I wonder if 20 years from now this isn't going to be a controversial idea at all.
You know, one of the things
that's being overly optimistic.
Yeah, it could be, but you know, even taking a step back from annihilationism, what's often discussed, you know, maybe we are evolving a little bit, because I think that there was a time when it wasn't just eternal torment, but it was eternal torture, physical torture. More people believed in that. And it would be interesting. I know you have a poll up on your website, and actually it's rather interesting because right now, I don't know, I kind of took a little snapshot of it before the show, and it's kind of hard to know who's coming to your site, but I'm sure it's interesting that 40% of the people who voted believe in eternal torment. And something that I was thinking about there is often, in fact, Lee Strobel did this in his book, where he questioned eternal torture, but he advocated for eternal separation from God, which would be a form of torment, but not as extreme as burning in the fire kind of torment. And
right.
I find that that's become much more popular, and a lot of people that I know who've believed in hell, they find that much easier to accept, and they are accepting it. Many evangelicals are accepting that versus burning in the pit of hell version of torment. Although I will say they don't necessarily think it through all the way, because anyone who's ever been in mental anguish of any kind, I mean, it really would be torment to be in that kind of anguish. It's not that much kinder and gentler. I mean, it truly is torment to be separated, but, you know, you're not advocating the burning of the flesh, you know, eternally. And now some people are. You know, that forum that I was involved in years ago, there were some writings on there that were horrible, how, you know, God preserved the body in hell, you know, solely so that you would feel the torture for eternity.
Yeah.
and all this. I mean, it was just so horrible. And I know you talk about, like, with the Westboro people, there is a glee over that. And to me, that's, you know, it's just not right. There's something really, really wrong there. There's some people who've been deeply wounded to truly feel that way.
Yeah, well, I think so. You know, I think there is a sense of a psychological projection that people have been hurt, and so they hope that the people who hurt them will suffer. But I think on the other side that there's a lot of people who just really feel this is the most faithful reading of the text, and they hold to a really literalist view. So, you know, the idea that there's a glee in people suffering, you know, throughout history, some people have said that will be one of the pleasures of heaven, is seeing those suffering in hell, and that in a sense you'll have a front row seat. And that would go to something like Revelation 14 that says the smoke of their torment will rise forever, and they'll be tormented in the presence of the Lamb and all that sort of thing. But again, that's to take a very literalistic view of Scripture. And I think this is one of the problems, again, is that people are reading, you know, people are making all kinds of interpretive decisions, but not recognizing that's what they're doing. So they'll say, well, no, I just read the Bible literally. Well, if you read Revelation 14 literally, then you also have to concede that Jesus literally is a lamb, and that, you know, I would say that then he probably was a lamb throughout the Gospels, which would seem strange that nobody happened to mention that. But they would say, oh, no, don't be ridiculous. We know that that's just figurative in that passage, that in Revelation 14, when they say he's a lamb, it's more just a figure of speech. And I would say, okay, well, you just made an interpretive decision there. What is that based on? And if you are free to say that's symbolic, well, could the lake of fire be symbolic too? Oh, no, definitely not. Well, but how do you know? And so there's people out there who claim to be reading the Bible literally, but they're actually making a series of interpretive decisions without even being aware of it. But then they turn around to someone who has a different view, like a universalist, and they'll say that they don't consider the Bible an authority because they're imposing an interpretation. Well, the news break is that we are all imposing an interpretation on the text. None of us read the Bible the way it is.
Right.
We all read the Bible the way we are. And so we're going to emphasize some texts over others. We're always going to have our set of texts that become like a control text. So for a universalist, for instance, you'll take something out of Romans 11 where it says that God has turned all people over to disobedience, so he might have mercy on all. And so this becomes a text that says, well, this is God's goal, is that, you know, is ultimately to redeem everyone, so they'll read the rest of the Bible through that text. Or someone who believes in eternal torment will take something like John 3:16, and they'll read the rest of the Bible through that lens. But again, the thing I always want to draw people's attention to is that we are all making these interpretive decisions. And who am I to point at you and say, the decisions you're making make you a heretic? Like, who am I to say that mine are right? None of us has a leg up on the other. And this is why I think that rather than pointing fingers at each other and condemning each other, we need to be listening to each other, because we're all subjective. None of us has an objective take on Scripture. And so I think it's important that we read it as a community and we listen to each other as a community. This is the way the Jews would read the text, is all never on your own. You would always read it as a group and then discuss it and work the text together as a community. I think that's really important. Unfortunately, right now, we're in a position where certain people think they have the corner on the truth and they're trying to shut other people out.
Well, and I'll even say that if you have not been called, if you have not been so inspired, you can't understand it. That's the other thing I've often heard, because there is a verse that I can't quote it exactly, but you know that unless you're given a certain understanding by the Holy Spirit, you won't understand it. And so they are not necessarily able to engage in discussions. And yet what you say, you know, it's essentially come, let us reason together. And, you know, I am such an advocate for that. In fact, that's one of the reasons I started just spontaneously doing this show, is just to sit down and talk to each other. In fact, if I get really adventurous, I may start doing even kind of like what you did in your film to some degree, in that inviting people with really different points of view on the show. You know, an evangelical minister, and instead of arguing with them, though, talking. And I really am looking forward to actually seeing your film. And actually, we're kind of winding down in time, and I probably should give you a chance to talk about that. Now, I do know that one of the groups in Portland that has an interest in your film, and I know that I'm going to your film with the founder, to your Q&A session. We just made the plans. I don't know who else will be there, but it's Sue Elliott, the founder of Portland Christians with Questions, and that group has really grown. It was like it's grown to about 160 people. They don't all come to the meetings, but it's fascinating. And she was a worship leader and had a lot of questions she felt couldn't be answered in church. And these are, you know, sincere Christians who have questions, exactly what the group conveys. So I know they're interested in your movie. And so why don't you talk about, since I've got some audience in Portland, but then I also have audience nationwide, talk about the film, where it's touring, and the Q&A sessions that you're doing.
For sure. So yeah, so Hellbound is a feature-length documentary. We've been playing in theaters across the country since basically we did a pre-screening on September 12th in Nashville, and we've been in New York and L.A. and all over the place. And so yeah, we'll be coming to Portland, to Beaverton actually, on October 16th. I'm going to be there to do a Q&A screening, and the movie opens to do a regular one-week run on the 19th. So the 16th is kind of a sneak preview, and I'll be there to answer questions and that sort of thing, and then going on the 19th. And we also are going to be in Ashland, Oregon as well, and we're opening in Seattle. I'm actually going to be in Seattle doing a Q&A on the 15th, and I'll be in Ashland on the 17th and Bellingham, Washington on the 18th. So it's going to be a pretty busy week. And yeah, so it's so far I've done, I think, 9 Q&As across the country. It's just been a really great experience to dialogue with all kinds of people after the film, some people who agree with the film, some people who don't. And again, the film really isn't trying to promote a point of view per se. What we're trying to do in the film is to introduce people to three main ways of looking at hell. There's the idea of eternal torment, annihilationism, and then universalism, or ultimate reconciliation. And what we're trying to look at in Hellbound as well is, why is this such a contentious issue, and what's the connection between what we believe about hell and and the character of God, and also then the kind of world that we create based on our theology of hell. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to coming to Portland, and I think everyone should be part of that group. I think every Christian in Portland should have questions. And, you know, the question is there a safe place to ask those questions? Because I think if you can't come to church with your questions, where can you go? And
exactly.
People will say, well, you come to church with questions, but,
and
we can dialogue about this. But it's like, yeah, but only if we come to the conclusions that you approve of. What if our dialogue and our questions cause us to question some of our central assumptions? Are you actually willing to go there? Are you willing to put everything on the table in pursuit of truth, including your view of God? Because your view of God might actually be the biggest thing standing between you and truth. Because you've built up this image of God in your mind that is just a total aberration. And so I think, are we bold enough? Do we trust God enough to go there? You know, I really would want to put that challenge out to people. And I think that this is just, to me, asking these questions about hell, the two-year process I've spent on Hellbound has just been one of the most liberating experiences of my life. Mm-hmm. And I feel a greater love for God, a greater reverence for the Bible, and a greater desire to tell people what I've discovered than I've ever felt in my life.
Well, I can really feel your heartfelt sincerity. I mean, you've obviously discovered something. And, you know, I feel like our misconceptions about God, this was certainly my experience, they don't just distance us from truth, they distance us from God. How can you have a personal relationship with God if you can't trust God, or if you're, you know, questioning with anguish these horrendous things that just don't resonate with your heart? I mean, it's really very sad, and I've lived that. I know what that's like, and I'm still trying to heal the wounds from that. And, you know, it's a walk of trust every day, an exploration, and I think many people are like me, that, you know, we really want to experience the love of God fully. And I sense that that's the path that you're very much on, just through how you speak, Kevin. And
I think we are on a similar journey that way. And, you know, I think you're right that it alienates us from God, but I think it also alienates us from each other. Right now the fact that I'm asking these questions, you know, causes my parents no small degree of anxiety.
Oh, of course.
And because there's a fear that comes up that I might be leading people astray. I might be putting people in danger of hell. And I would think, boy, if my little movie is a threat to God, well, God doesn't have very much going on. You know, I can't imagine that God, if he really is God, he wouldn't even have to snap his fingers and the threat of my movie is gone. I think that the Bible is a record of people asking questions and always amending their view in light of new information. What is Jesus constantly doing? He's constantly correcting the way that the religious leaders of his day are interpreting the scriptures. You've heard it said this. Well, I say this.
Mm-hmm.
And even Paul, the Apostle Paul, one of the most important theologians in the New Testament, is doing exactly the same thing. And I think what they're constantly trying to do is separate the idea of God from retribution and violence. And I think that you'll see that progressing throughout the scripture, is that people believe that violence is coming from God, and they eventually come to understand that no, actually, humans are the source of this stuff, and God is trying to deliver us from that sort of thing, not trying to sanctify it by delivering the ultimate violence in hell. I just think that that is the opposite of what Jesus came to teach us.
Absolutely. And, you know, our beliefs about violence, they influence the society. So I just want to direct people to your website, which is hellboundthemovie.com, and there's a link on the show page. And I just wanted to make a quick note that the resources page on that site is amazing. Oh, and by the way, we won't cut off right at the hour. The live show will go off, but it'll go over a few seconds if we need it. But the thing is that resource page, Kevin, looks like something well worth exploring. It has quite depth to it, and I can't wait to spend more time with it, quite honestly. So, and also to see your film. I'm really looking forward to that next week, and we'll certainly introduce ourselves to you when we're there. And I'm very appreciative that you would come on this show, and I'm sure the audience appreciates that. We do have listeners in other parts of the country as well, and I encourage people to go see this film because I think it's a form of healing within our society is what it truly is. It is for us to have an honest dialogue.
Yes, I think that's good. I mean, healing, I think for me, this is really part of my own personal journey toward healing and toward freedom. And, yeah, and I encourage people, check out the website because we have a page there that lists all the theaters that we're in and all the theaters that we're going to be in. So take a look there. And, yeah, we will be in Portland starting on the 16th and many other places in the Northwest. We're actually opening in Vancouver, B.C. as well this Friday. So, yeah, it's been very exciting. We have other cities in the works as well. And, yeah, I'm just excited about getting out there and meeting more people because it's been such a great experience so far.
Well, it sounds wonderful, and we really are looking forward to it. So thank you once again.
Well,
I'll be really interested to follow your work. I'll be interested to see what you do next.
Yeah, oh, good. Well, me too. But, yeah, well, it'll be great to meet you when I'm out in Portland. And everyone else, just make sure you say hello. Because, for me, one of the most enjoyable parts of all of this has been just really that interaction with people following the screening.
Yeah, and it's really kind of cool that you're doing the Q&As. I mean, it gives a real personal touch to the film as well. So,
yeah.
So, all right. Well, thanks again. I appreciate you being with us today, and I appreciate the audience being with us. And this show will be available in the archive, so I welcome those who are listening in the archive. It's available in podcast form. And I do hope that people will find the show as the movie's coming to their city, because I know this will be touring for a little while yet.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed my time here.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. Good evening.
Take care.
Well, thanks again for being with us here today. I just wanted to make a show note. The next show is going to be Sunday at 10 a.m., and I am going to be interviewing Susie Miller, who has studied alternative approaches to autism. So she's going to be coming back on the show. And then a week from Friday, I'm going to have Catherine Lucas on the show, who is the author of a book called Spiritual Emergency, which is actually quite relevant to this topic because sometimes if your belief system is so based in fear, it can actually lead to some pretty dysfunctional behavior in our lives and fear-based things that can occur to the point that it really does put us in a state of spiritual emergency. And by the same token, when we awaken very quickly, that too can occur where we basically overload our system. So Catherine Lucas will be talking to us about that, and I wanted to mention it since today is World Mental Health Day, and I know she's really trying to get the word out that the way that our spiritual points of view affect us really does have an effect on our mental health, and it's actually something that the mental health practitioners themselves are beginning to recognize more and more, how spirituality really has an influence on people. So that show is a week from Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific on October 19th. And then one more I'll tell you about, as long as I've got you here, is a week after that, Sue Elliott, the person I mentioned earlier of Portland Christians with Questions, she's returning to the show, and she and I are going to take on the topic of the women's right to choose, and we're going to do it in a very honest and respectful way and really try to look at the different issues involved with that. So it's going to be a pretty courageous show that we're going to do. And that show will be, that one's still, let's see, I think it's the 26th. So I'm losing track of time now. Yeah, October 26th, Friday at the 11 a.m. Pacific time. So if you want to learn more about the Frontier Beyond Fear, just go to frontierbeyondfear.com. www.thefreedomfighters.com, and you can see upcoming guests as well as ways to support the show if you are so interested. So thank you again for being here today, and I hope that we can all take from this show that lesson of let's start listening to each other. Why be afraid of having a dialogue about these such important topics? If we could all just sit down and come, let us reason together, we would really begin to find truth. And not only just that, we would begin to truly see where others are coming from, and suddenly we wouldn't be so separated from one another, and we'd find that many of us sincerely, want to live a life in true communion with God. And, you know, if we're an atheist or an agnostic, we have a point of view that is worthy of understanding if we can only dialogue together. So I will leave you with that thought tonight, and I will see you next time. Thank you so much.